Welcome to the Veritas Podcast. For even more exciting content, visit our website at www.veritaswbc.com. Enjoy the podcast.
Can we really say that all religions are basically the same? Can we say that? And it's going to take me a little bit to unpack it just in the sense of, because this question happens in some layers, but it's a popular thing to hear. In the second century, in fact, there was a pagan named Celsus. So it didn't take very long, right? So in the first century, you know, you go back to the time of Jesus, you go just a little bit after. In the second century, a pagan named Celsus attacked Christianity, and he said, I was quoting him, "It makes no difference if one invokes the highest God or Zeus or Adonai or Sabaoth or Amun, as the Egyptians do, or even as the Scythians do." In other words, he says all religions are basically the same. Here's basically the idea that you might hear threaded behind it. So long as what somebody believes, they're sincere in their belief, then why should you have a problem with it? Sincere beliefs are good. You might even be familiar with a parable. There's a parable of an Indian blind men who are touching different parts of an elephant. And this goes back a long time ago, but here's the idea. You have the king and his couriers, think just his people, right? And they blindfold these guys and they take them up to the side of an elephant and they ask them, well, how would you describe an elephant? And as you can imagine, depending on where they're at the elephant, they describe the elephant in very different ways, from a vantage point, so to speak. So if one is at the tail, well, it might feel a lot like a rope and in fact describe the elephant as a rope. Or if you're beside the side, it may be something like a tree or a large wall or, you know, get around the tusk and so maybe a snake. Or if you're touching the ears, maybe you describe an elephant as a fan or the tusk is what I say, maybe a spear, right? And this is the idea. They argue, you know, about who's right, but in the words of the poem, what they get is they get the wrong conclusion. The whole idea of it was, at least when it was developed, was to say we all have a vantage point, and we all have these beliefs, and we hold them sincerely. I'm not questioning that. We hold these beliefs very sincerely. But if you even think about the nature of the parable and what it's trying to communicate, it actually communicates the opposite point. It doesn't prove that an elephant that the ear of an elephant is like a big leaf or that the tusk is like a spear. It doesn't prove that at all. Because when you look at the way the parable was structured, what in fact you have is you have the king and his people who blindfold. By definition, they don't see the elephant for what the elephant really is. Instead, the king and his couriers, they see the elephant for what it is. So I'm sitting there going, okay. So really, in an effort to prove that we can't really know what the elephant is, you've showed us that we can know what the elephant is. You just have to have the vantage point of the king. You may have seen something like this. Have you seen these things going around in social media where maybe one person is facing this way and it looks like a six? Have you seen that? And then another person is facing this way and it looks like a nine, and they're talking to each other and one goes six and the other goes nine. Have you seen that? Well, I was seeing that one, well, even last night, and a person was commenting about it and saying, yeah, exactly, that's just the way that we should see things. And I thought, no, that's exactly wrong. That isn't the way that we should see things. Maybe instead of coming to a judgment about the matter, we should realize that somebody wrote the number down on the floor, and we need to ask them, what were you writing? And then we get their meaning, not just one that we created for ourselves. I call that the problem of the six or the nine, right? Now, for those of you that are on social media, you're probably going to run into something like that. The problem is, like I said, it just doesn't make the point that you're hoping that it makes. So you can see some other illustrations out there, because really what we're dealing with is what's called the problem of pluralism. And the idea of pluralism is more simply to say that all religions are basically the same, or perhaps religions are like roads that lead to a mountaintop. There's one top, and there are a lot of different paths that get you to the top. So for me, somebody would say, so you're a Christian, and that's the path that you're taking to get to the top. But some of my friends are actually practicing Buddhists, and so that's the path that they're taking to get to the top. Or maybe you could say that religions are like a mosaic, right? You get the idea, in which a numbering of different beliefs make up a complete and beautiful pattern about the nature of God and ultimate reality. This is what we're talking about when we talk about the problem of pluralism. Now, I want to be even more clear. One naive view is basically just to say, okay, so all religions are basically the same. Well, somebody might say that, but that takes about 2 seconds to, when you think about it, to say that doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, people who say that all religions essentially are alike haven't really studied religions very carefully because they're completely unalike in a lot of different ways. Let me give you an idea. I don't know how many of you have heard of Christian Science. And let me be clear, that's different than Christianity. But Christian Science denies the reality of evil. Evil doesn't even exist. Sickness. This is an illusion. Sin, sickness, and death. They don't buy it, but an Orthodox Christian is going to acknowledge that that's just a part of the fallen world that we live in. These things are real. So it can't be both ways. We contradict each other. A Muslim. I have Muslim friends. They'll deny that Jesus died on the cross. If you look at the fourth surah in the Quran, that's exactly what it says. And basically it says he swooned, which more or less is just a way of saying Jesus passed out and maybe somebody else took his place on the cross. But there's no way that you would read the Gospels and get that, for example. So you have conflicting, in fact, not just conflicting, you have contradicting testimony between the Quran and the New Testament. It can't be both ways. If you're a theist, this is the idea that this somebody believes that God exists. You believe that there's a creator. Well, in that case, you're probably not going to be a Buddhist because their view is that ultimately there is no God. They're functionally atheists. So by definition, I want to say this about truth. Because there have been a number of times where when I visit with people, you know, they'll say, well, don't you think maybe you're being a little bit arrogant for thinking that you have the truth? And I'm like, well, I don't think I'm being arrogant. Arrogant might be an attitude that I would have toward the truth or the way that I present myself with the truth that I believe. But that's different than saying I'm an arrogant person. And we wouldn't say this in other categories if you think about it. When you take a math test, maybe let's say for a second, because we have students here tonight, you ace it, right? You nail it. Good. Here's the thing. The teacher doesn't put back, by the way, you're arrogant. You got everything right. You know, I mean, it just doesn't work like that. We don't say that when there's certain scientific truths, well, if you really believe that and you really hold to that. And moreover, if you tell somebody that they're wrong because they deny that, you know what? You're arrogant. We don't do that. And so we shouldn't do it when it comes to religious discourse either. Somebody is getting it right and others are getting it wrong. So here's the thing. By definition, truth excludes something. Truth rules some things out. And one of the things that truth rules out, everybody, is falsehood. That's what it rules out. Christians and Buddhists, we can't both be right on what happens when you die. Either God exists, by the way, or God doesn't exist. Muslims and Christians, we can't both be right about Jesus's death. Hindus, my Hindu friends, they believe in reincarnation. That's incompatible with Christianity. So when you think about Christianity, the Christian's view of the afterlife involves something pretty simple: death, judgment, and then union or separation from God. But it can't be both ways. They're contradicting each other. You get the idea. Truth, by definition, rules something out. And what it rules out is what's false. It's gone. Second, and I want to be very clear here. All truth is God's truth. All truth is God's truth. Thomas Aquinas said this. I'm saying it right now. And here's what that means. That means that other religions aren't necessarily 100% wrong. Did you hear what I said? There may be some truth in other worldviews. Some. Jesus describes himself as the way, the truth, and the life in John 14:6. You remember that. So when we assert that God's revelation in Jesus is true, we're not saying non-Christian religions are wholly false or that Christ followers have a monopoly on the truth. I don't think we're saying anything like that, or at least I hope not. And here's why. Because we can say, for instance, that Muslims are a lot closer to truth than Buddhists on some things. After all, Muslims believe that God exists and God created. We believe the same thing. God exists and God created. Jewish friends, the same way. We're not talking about secular Jews. We're talking about theistic Jews. Same thing. They believe that God exists and that the origin and the creation of the world is from God, going back to Genesis 1. We would actually agree with them on that. A number of religions affirm common belief in human rights. Have you noticed we did the abortion discussion last week? And a lot of what I said, a Jew or a Muslim could totally agree with, because they would say, yeah, we are created in the image of God. And as a result, we have certain, well, value. We're intrinsically valuable. So religions can affirm belief in human rights. They can affirm personal virtue. Even affirm religious liberty, your right to practice your Christian faith and their right to practice their Muslim faith. You get the idea. So to say that a religion is maybe wrong in one area doesn't mean that they're wrong carte blanche just across the board. They may be getting some things right. It's just something that we need to remember, because this brings up another important point. Where we agree provides a common ground for us that is helpful in facilitating a conversation. We can focus so much on what it is that we disagree about that we can lose scope and perspective on some things that we agree about, and then work our way out from there. Let me give you some examples. Paul Copan gives us, and I think it's just a great example. He said, some rule-driven religions have similarities to the Mosaic Law's rule, as, you know, they believe that the Mosaic Law is like a tutor. It teaches you basically how it is that you're missing the mark. There's a lot more to the law than that, but you get the idea. It's a good teacher. Other religions other than Christianity can have this belief that the law is good to protect us. It's like a schoolmaster. And even if you look at Galatians 3:24, it says, by the way, it's the law that lets you know that you need Jesus, right? Because you know who you aren't when you take a look at it. None of us live up to it, really. But then you think of the Confucian view, for example. They have a high view of community and benevolence, but so do Christians. A high view of community and benevolence. Love to others in an ordered society. And it paves the way, by the way, when you think about it, and this is why I like Copan's point. He said it paves the way for understanding the fuller biblical concept of Christian love. Buddhists, by the way, they have a doctrine that emphasizes what's called a self-sacrificial bodhisattva. I don't expect you to write that down. But here's the idea. What they think is that we're trapped, that the problem isn't sin and we need a savior, that we need enlightenment. So obviously we disagree there. However, they have these people that they describe as bodhisattvas. These are the ones that are enlightened. They get the truth. And what they'll do is they'll actually postpone nirvana. They'll postpone this, not the band, but they will postpone a perfect state of peace, by the way, to help people like me and you enter it. And the whole thing that is there is this doctrine emphasizes self-sacrifice. Do you find anything in the Christian narrative that emphasizes self-sacrifice and to regard others before yourself? If nothing else, we have to think of the cross. It's the greatest example of just such a point. So you get the idea. Simply because other religions are wrong in some, and I'll say in some very important ways, doesn't mean that they're wrong about everything whatsoever. I hope that helps a little bit. So while we might disagree about how much benefit, like even if you think about this, some have debated, you know, why we would read somebody like Plato and Aristotle. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. I had to read all that stuff. But here was the thing. We're getting outside of the scope of pure Christianity when you think about it. But St. Augustine, one of the great thinkers in the history of the Christian church, was very influenced by Plato. If you want to understand him, you have to know Plato. How about Thomas Aquinas? He's the theologian of the Catholic Church. He's the theologian of the Catholic Church. And he was enormously influenced by Aristotle. You get the idea? And here's why. And this was the point. Is because all truth is God's truth. All truth is God's truth. So here's what that means. That means that we have to be careful when we're listening to somebody to where it is that we're agreeing, but also the key areas with which we're disagreeing, and work our way out from common ground to get to a place that we can have a meaningful conversation about it. I mean, I'll say it. You know, the Christian faith claims to be true, but by the way, everything else claims to be true too. Right? It claims to be true. And where another religion contradicts it, at that point, I would say they're in error. At that point, they're in error. One of the people that was really informative in shaping this is a guy named John Hick. And what he said and what he believed was, he said, religion can bring us, and I'll just quote him, to a right relationship with the ultimate divine reality, to awareness of our true nature and our place in the whole, and even to the presence of God. And you go, which one? And he's like, yep, all of them. All of them. And here's why. He said, I'll agree that there are unavoidable contradictions between like Islam and Christianity. He said, I have to because there are. You can't get away from that. But he said, but what they're all trying to do is to get us past ourselves to ultimate reality. And if a religion does that, then it's done its job, whether it's Muslim or Christian or otherwise. And that's something that I want to give just a little bit of thought to here, because that's the part that I say, no, because it's the key areas of disagreement that we really need to center on then. When you think about it, and this is just basically the way that I want to close, at least for this part of our conversation tonight, and then we'll go to some questions. One problem with the idea, because what Hick is buying into is the idea of the mountain, right? There's one peak, and there are many paths that will get you to it. But one problem with the mountaintop analogy is that analogies often don't prove a point. Or in fact, why do I have to buy that analogy to start with? Why say there are many paths that lead you to the top? This is the example that Copan gave. He said, how about this? If Jesus is truly unique, maybe the world's religions are like a maze or a labyrinth, and there's one way out. Why not look at it that way? I mean, what if God and Jesus steps into the maze and then he walks us through it? That would be a completely different conclusion than saying there are many paths and there's one top, and we all just get there. Let me give you one other thing to think about, because some of the differences in religious beliefs are pretty substantial in the way that they work themselves out. I've given this example before here at the church and in some sermons, but Mahatma Gandhi, when he was in a place where he was really searching for the truth, he went into a church, and he was basically met in what would functionally be the foyer. And as you probably remember, Gandhi was rather dark-skinned. There were some men that met him in the foyer and told him that he wasn't welcome to worship in that place. Now, that was a huge mistake. One, because it doesn't fit anything in the teachings of Jesus that I can find. But the other thing was, and this is what people have wondered, I mean, what would have happened had Gandhi actually walked out with the message of Christianity rather than going back to what was his native religious belief in Hinduism? And here was the thing. Even Gandhi said the greatest person that shaped the way that he saw everything was Jesus himself, and he would have been a Christian if it weren't for Christians, right? That's a tough line, but we kind of have to bite it. Sometimes people can't see the truth because we're obstructing it a little bit, right? Now, here's the thing. If you go over into India, India labors not just under Hinduism, but they labor under what's called the caste system. And the caste system is born from a religious belief that they have. I mean, the idea behind the caste system is a doctrine of karma. And let me be clear, this isn't like there's God up there that's judging. Karma works like law, basically like cause and effect. Karma works almost like a law of nature. Don't see it as divine judgment. See it as something like that. And so for the good that you invest in this life, maybe reincarnation, you'll come back as a higher manifestation in the next life. Or if not, maybe you'll come back as a lower manifestation in the next life. Here's the thing. Here's what that means. What that means is, and this was the problem that what Gandhi was dealing with. So what this means is you are in the place in life because of something that you have done. And as a result, what that means is I don't need to mess with the system. I don't need to mess with the system. I mean, if you've come back as a lower form, or if you've come back and you're basically a slave, or if you come, you get the idea? You are there because of something that you've done. And I'm not here to buck the system. This is what karma is. And guess what that did? That led to all kinds of injustices that were grounded on a theological framework. Whereas if you look, and I'm just trying to make an important point here, whereas if you look at the Christian narrative, I'm not so blind historically to say that Christians haven't manipulated the Bible so that they can basically take power over people and suppress them and oppress them. All you got to do is read a little bit. You'll figure that out. People are good at this. We will take anything, manipulate it for our own gain. The difference is what is intrinsic to the worldview versus something that people are manipulating about the worldview. And what you'll never find in Scripture, anything that you see in Jesus, is that he says, you treat people however you want to, however despicably that you want to. You will never find it. And you'll also never find something like karma. Instead, here's what you find. You find grace. You find grace. So why do I bring that up? I bring that up because I think it's a pretty powerful example to say something. And what I'm trying to say is, while on the surface it sounds really good, to celebrate a religious belief that a person has, the implications of the differences on those beliefs in some really key areas make us say that's a road that we can't go down. Because here's the thing, if Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father except through me, guess what he's doing? He's ruling everybody else out. Anything that denies what he says is out, and everyone who affirms what he's saying about himself is in. So at the end of the day, this is kind of the way I look at it. At the end of the day, what that means is I'm not the one that's the ground of the truth of Christianity. Jesus is. And I'm not the one that stated that Christianity was exclusively true. Jesus did. I'm the one that's telling people and telling you what he has said. So I think that's a good place to stop because I want to give some time to questions. So let's do that. Let me move this over here and out of the way. Hopefully some of you have a few things that you would like to ask. Isn't Alec doing a great job with this? Awesome. Let me help Melody out. I got you. You're welcome. And let me help Melody out. And then we'll turn to your questions.
Don't you love our nice new chair?
By the way, this chair gives Melody the lumbar support that she so desires.
What can I say? I require a lot from my chair.
Comfortable chairs.
These chairs are heavier than they look, though. I will tell there. You that. Okay, we have a lot of really good questions coming through. I'm kind of like trying to wade through them right now. These questions are kind of covering a broad array. Again, if you have a question, please go submit it at menti.com. Our code is on the screen, 68743. You can go to menti.com to join that discussion. And if you don't have a question, you can vote on which question you want him to answer. Okay, this is a good one, I think, to start with. If the basic belief, salvation, is the same, why do so many religious organizations exist and continue to split churches?
So the grounds for salvation are not the same. Let me repeat that. The grounds for salvation are not the same. This is interesting because if you look at that's why I was bringing up Buddhism, for example. The whole idea is that, you know, to exist is to suffer, right? And so if you want to break this cycle of birth and suffering and death, then you have to come to that understanding. So what's the afterlife like? In Orthodox Buddhism, it's non-existence. It's basically to be too subsumed into a void. You can't get more opposite than that to Christianity that would affirm your continued personal existence. By the way, heaven, it's here. It's just not yet. If you read the Bible, this place is restored, right? You'll continue to be a person, a human person with a body, by the way. That's the belief in the resurrection. So I bring that up more or less just to make a simple point. We're contradicting ourselves in a place of key disagreement. If you think of Muslims don't affirm the deity of Jesus, they don't affirm the death of Jesus, they don't affirm the resurrection of Jesus, they don't affirm the atoning work of Jesus. That's kind of a key area. So we might have some ethical agreements. We've got some huge salvific disagreements. Now, as far as within Christianity, is there a disagreement? Well, you know, that's why if you look in Ephesians 2 or you can look in Titus, you know, the whole thing is that the foundation of the faith is built on the work of Jesus and not on the work of us, right? What we do is we either accept the gift or we don't. And that's where grace, of course, has a pretty strong play. So is there anything in Christianity, at least in terms of Orthodox Christianity, that says your salvation comes by something that you've ever done? And the answer is from its root. The answer is no, not at all. Denominational differences are often not based on a question like that. Denominational differences are based on a lot of times other things, like how do you want to govern your local church? Do you want to be autonomous, meaning a self-governing entity? That's kind of the way that Baptists have always always run. We work in partnership with other Baptists, but we're our own church, right? Whereas if you look at Catholics or Catholicism, they're what's called hierarchical. So you have a local church, but it's governed from an entity outside of itself. But notice that's a difference that is largely functional at the end of the day, related to an issue that has nothing to do with salvation at all. So for me, I look at some of the differences in denominations within Christianity. I say, yeah, a lot of those differences aren't what we'd call on primary doctrines. They're on some other issues that are secondary or what you call tertiary, even further down the road.
That's a good word, tertiary.
It is a good word. Third, yeah. Like third or worse, right? Lower priority, basically.
Okay, this one has a lot of likes. Advocates of pluralism find it hard to believe that all non-Christians go to hell. How can you help facilitate a conversation with a non-believer about other religions and their fate in the afterlife? And this kind of harkens back to what you talked about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
But brings it a little closer to what you talked about today.
Right. Yeah, I think at the end of the day, think of Gandhi. Let me use him as an example. It wasn't like Gandhi was unaware of what Jesus was teaching. Gandhi wasn't unaware of what Jesus was saying about himself, right? And so when people look at Gandhi, they go, man, what a moral guy. By the way, he was a moral hit or miss. I mean, just go read some narratives about him, right? And he did some great things. I'm not going to take those things away from him. However, he knew what Jesus was saying about himself, and he walked away from it. And so this is the thing for, I think, of my Muslim friends. I'm saying, okay, do you have any questions about what Jesus is saying about himself? No. So you're rejecting what Jesus is saying about himself and what that means in terms of the decision that you're making. And the answer is yes. They just don't have the same belief. They don't have the same belief that I do. Then you get to the second part of the question, which is, okay, so what are the consequences of that choice? I mean, at the end of it, Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, right? There's a path that Christianity is. And here's what that means. What that means is that you can choose any path that you want to. You just don't choose the consequences that come with the path. It doesn't work like that. You don't get to choose whatever you want and then tell Jesus he's obligated to honor things just because you wanted to work that way. So to reject, and this is the thing about his work on the cross, to reject his work on the cross is to reject the purpose of his incarnation, right? Is to reject the purpose of the whole thing when you think about it. So that being said, and you can look in scripture, you know, God at every turn, he gives a prophet, he gives his word, he gives everything to communicate. And then you go, okay. And then he holds us responsible for what it is that he has entrusted to us. So that's the second, kind of in response to the second part, is he takes it. And think of the dignity, by the way, that goes with that. The dignity that God is basically reckoning to us by honoring the choice that we've made, when you think about it. Even if the result is a hard one, he's honoring it. So my job, by the way, is just to make it clear what is Christianity, what isn't it? And then at that point, hand it over to the person. It's that person's decision to make. Again, a lot of these folks aren't wondering what it is that Christianity is saying. Now, that being said, I'm going to give you a promissory note. I'm going to cash one out for you another night. But there's another question that's embedded in this question. It's about what about those that don't hear the gospel? I'm not answering that right now. Here's why. I'm going to answer it another night, okay? Because it's a fair question. But that's totally different than like a Gandhi who heard it and just said, I'm going another way.
I think this is a really good follow-up question. And you started unpacking this a little bit, so maybe you can unpack it a little bit more for us. What is enough absolute truth? If Baptist theology is 100% correct, do Jews go to heaven or Catholics or Methodists or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's what I would just go with Paul in Romans 10. And I would say, if you believe in your heart and confess with your mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord and that God raised him from the dead, you're saved. Period. That's it. What about some denominational distinctions? If you believe in your heart and confess with your mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord and God raised him from the dead, I'll see you in glory. By the way, my mentor through my PhD was Catholic. He was Catholic. And we had some amazing conversations, you know, as I was researching and writing, and he was telling me I was wrong about everything, right? That was his job. You're wrong. You're wrong. But here was the thing. In some of those conversations that we had, if you had ever asked him, what is the gospel, I don't think any Baptist would have a problem with what he said. I just don't. not by sitting at the table with him. Who is Jesus? He would tell you. And it would sound a lot like what I would tell you. Again, a lot of those differences aren't necessarily, and can I just encourage you, take it case by case, take it person by person, because you never know what is going to come out of the mouth of somebody. They'll describe themselves as a Catholic, but then they haven't read, for example, the catechisms of the Catholic Church, right? And they're just kind of off, I'm Catholic, but they're not saying anything that really represents the Catholic Church. Let me just put that out there for you, right? By the way, Baptists do the same thing. I'm Baptist, and then they say things, you're like, you're what? I don't know what you are. So maybe take it case by case, but I want to focus in on what is the essential thing about Christianity. And I think Romans 10 is sufficient to make the point. If you believe in what? In your heart, confess with your mouth that he is Lord, which means you put yourself under him for all matters of life and belief. What does it say? And God raised him from the dead. You're saved. I think that's the crux of it. I don't have to make it any more complicated than that. Focus on that. That's where the answer is.
Thank you. That's very helpful to unpack. Okay, so this one's a good one. Christians are seen often as close-minded and bigoted, while some other religions, religious followers are more tolerant. How do we have a discussion about our religion versus other religion when our reputation is against us in our culture?
So how do you have a good conversation? I think the first thing is you tolerate what you disagree with, by definition. You don't tolerate what you agree with, you agree with it. You tolerate what you disagree with. Tolerance is not, by the way, about whether or not what you're saying is true or that you believe it's true. Because whoever's across the table from you, guess what? They believe what they're saying is true, right? The key is to disagree without being disagreeable. And by the way, especially in the political climate we got right now, that's tough. I mean, it is like never-ending snark out there right now. And it just doesn't facilitate anything that's healthy or good. So that's why I was even saying when I was talking, can we find some common ground and work our way out? And here's why, is because it helps facilitate a good conversation so that we can meaningfully, and though disagreeing, we're not being disagreeable on the things that we come to and say, that's something we have to talk about. Nabil Qureshi, I would encourage you to go check out some stuff by Nabil Qureshi. I got to know Nabil before he died, and just a great guy, brilliant guy. But here was the thing, Nabil goes into a debate, and he kind of shares this story. He's like, I'm fully pulling for Shabir Ali, who's one of the top Muslim scholars in the world. He's like, I'm on his team, right? He's a Muslim, raised in and embedded in the culture and everything. He says, I go in, he said, by the time that thing's over with, I'm like, oh man, we've got problems, right? He said, because the case for the resurrection of Jesus was so strong. He said, but even with that, I was like, nope, I'm not gonna buy it. And it was after a period of time and a friendship with David Wood that Nabil says, ultimately, I came around to saying, this is true. This is true. And what I don't need to have is just beliefs that I've always had. I need to have true beliefs, even if my previous ones were sincerely held. I need to have true beliefs. And you need to think of the cost that this guy was counting. Because one of the things that we would never say, at least in Christianity, is you're born a Christian. No, you're not. You might be born to Christian parents and Christian influence, but you're not born a Christian. You have to choose it. However, in Islam, it's a little bit different. It's a part of the culture. You're born into a whole culture. You're born into a whole way of life. And what that means is to walk to Jesus is to walk away from the whole culture, which means that mom, dad, brother, sister, aunt, uncle, and so forth. And this is why you hear in these Muslim testimonies something like this. They are going, if they're not going to try to kill me, they're certainly going to disown me. They're certainly going to disown me. So that's why I'm saying your approach. Always have a defense for the hope that's within you. 1 Peter 3:15 and 16 says, but present yourself with gentleness and respect. Present yourself with gentleness and respect. All right, I'll give you one example that was me when I was a lot younger. Are you ready? So I just had rolled out of my PhD. I was teaching at New Orleans Seminary. We had a thing called the Greer Heard Forum there. And we had a topic, atheism. And so we had Daniel Dennett come in, who's one of the four horsemen of atheism. Just Google his name, you're going to get blitzed, right? And then we had Alistair McGrath, come in. We also had William Lane Craig and some others that came in. Now, here was the thing. So we're eating at Emerald Lagasse's. So we're over on St. Charles. Guys, go there sometime. It's worth it, all right? So we're eating at Emerald's, and I'm sitting next to Alistair McGrath. At the time, he was teaching at Oxford, right? Guys, two PhDs. One's in theology. One is in something in biology. Now I'm trying to remember. Anyway, two PhDs. And I'm talking to McGrath, right? And I just kind of leaned over, and I said, hey, you know, when you guys were debating, I couldn't help but notice that his jugular was kind of sticking out of his neck about that far. You know, why didn't you at least poke at it a little bit, right? And I'm in my 20s, so what do I know, right? And here's what he says. I'll never forget this, because we're leaning over the table a little bit, because Dennett was, by the way, right over here. So we're saying it very quietly, right? And he says, yeah, when I was young like you, I like to poke people in the jugular too. And I was like, okay, let's eat, right? Now, now, here was the thing, and this was McGrath's point, and this was his point. You know, are you there just to wear somebody out? Is that what you're there for? That was his point. Are you there to win? Are you there for them to know the Lord? And your approach, a lot of times, is the difference. So always have a defense for the hope that's within you. Present yourself with gentleness and respect. Respect. So disagree, but don't be disagreeable.
I think we should needlepoint that on a pillow.
Yeah. I'm the best bad example to use, by the way, right? You know, I throw myself under the bus. So there you go.
That's good. That's really good. So I think we started a few minutes late because of pie and cake. So
that's
I think
fine.
It's perfectly reasonable for us to go a few minutes over, right? Right? Yeah, sure. Okay. Okay, so I think this question is directed at millennials, and as a millennial, I'm interested to hear your response.
All my comments will be directed at Melody then. The millennials are the most studied generation of all time, by the way. So
we're also the current whipping post. So you know, we'll just take it. We'll own it. That's fine.
All right.
Okay. So what do you say to a generation that says truth isn't worth identifying? And then there's a bonus question: is that in itself a truth?
Okay, so the truth isn't worth identifying. I would point this out. They don't really believe that. They don't really believe that. One of the examples that I gave before is nobody believes that when it comes to medicine. Nobody believes that. Nobody. Nobody sits there and goes, hey, you know what, today I think I'll take rat poison. You know why? It's because we got some beliefs about rat poison. Instead, you're probably going to be aiming for your antibiotic, right? Nobody believes it, and that's the thing. It's not just that we don't believe it. We don't believe it because you know it's unlivable and inherently unlivable. I would just start with that. You know, practically speaking, how does that work? It doesn't. Nobody would buy that when it comes to, you know, the key discoveries in science. Nobody would. Nobody would do that in math. Nobody would. So we don't need to do it when it comes to God, because here's why. It's one thing to have a belief, and it's a totally different thing to say, my beliefs make God who he is. No, they don't. What you hope is that your beliefs correspond to who God is. They match, so to speak. But that is a totally different thing than to say my beliefs make God up. I mean, how offensive would it be if just to take the question, you know, how about this? What if I were to say, you know what? You actually don't have any personal identity until I tell you who you are. How would that settle with you? My guess is probably not well. So if it's not going to work on the human level, I'm going to suggest it's not going to work on the human divine level. Our beliefs don't make God who he is. So I think that's enough maybe to put that part of the question aside. Can you repeat the second part for me real quick?
Just, is that in itself a truth, an absolute truth?
Well, with the way that it was framed, I don't think it's a truth, because remember what I was saying, that it's not worth pursuing was really the nature of the question. That really gets to the heart of what is going on, though. At the end of the day, you know what most people are dealing with? They're dealing with a flat indifference. That's what they're dealing with. It's not like most people are walking out there saying, you know, I actually have the argument against the existence of God that disproves his existence. That has not been found, by the way. It's not there. Instead, people just don't care. And that's a totally different thing. So I think the second part of the question, what I will say, is it represents very well a demographic that's one of the fastest growing demographics in our country right now, and that's called the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not the N-U-N-S, by the way, right? The N-O-N-E-S. And so you say, well, what affiliation do you have? What beliefs do you hold? And they go, none, none. They don't care. They're just going to do life, and they're content to do it. I think the second part of that question represents that belief really well. And here's to what tune. Rasmussen would say that about 35% of our country right now is falling in that category. They don't even care. Now think about that. Think about that. If God exists, I'm just going to say if God exists and he has spoken to the way that our relationship with him is supposed to go, and what happens as a result of walking away from that, I can't think of anything more important to think about than that. Than that. It's worth it. Even if it's hard. You know what? I don't know God exhaustively. By the way, neither do the angels in heaven. I don't know God exhaustively. But it's totally different to say I don't know God exhaustively and I don't know him accurately. And I can know accurately without knowing every detail about who God is. I can still know God accurately. By the way, I don't know everything about my wife, but I know my wife, right? I don't know her exhaustively, which is a bit of a mystery. But I would say this, I know her accurately. And I think that's another important thing to add in.
I think that's a good place for us to stop.
Okay.
And I think that that's a really good challenge for those of us who would say that we have a relationship with God, that that is a challenge for us in order to counteract those who are apathetic and just don't care. We have to care deeply, and we have to care about them deeply and share these things. So I really appreciate you
tying
that together.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information on Veritas, visit www.veritaswbc.com.